Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining today's conference call. I'm Elizabeth Kerr with Business Forward, and I'll be moderating our conversation today. Currently, all of your lines are in listen-only mode. Funding cuts at the State Department and talks with North Korea and a travel ban that targets Muslim countries, with all of those things in the news, we thought it would be important to have a conversation about how America's approach to foreign policy has really changed over the past 18 months. And we're pleased to welcome Jake Sullivan to our call today. And he's going to talk about what all of those topics and others mean for America's both national and economic security. Jake is co-chair of National Security Action, and he's a former National Security Advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, and he was Director of Policy and Planning at the State Department. Just so everybody's aware, this is an interactive phone briefing, so after Jake's comments, we are going to open it up to your questions and comments and advice for us. For those of you who are new to our programming, Business Forward organizes local roundtables, Washington fly-ins, conference calls, webinars, and media trainings for more than 100,000 business leaders across the country. And at these briefings, entrepreneurs and investors and small business owners and executives all get the chance to brief policymakers on issues that affect their business and how Washington can work better with the business community to accelerate the economy. More than 600 mayors, governors, members of Congress, and senior administration officials have participated in our programming, and this is all thanks to the support of more than 60 of America's most respected companies and foundations. Before we get started, I need to cover a few housekeeping items. First, just a reminder that this call is on the record, but that also means we will be able to release a recording of the call afterward in case you missed anything or would like to share it with anybody you know who might be interested and wasn't able to join us today. Also, as I mentioned, this is an interactive phone briefing, and so there will be time for you to ask questions and share your advice. You can do that in one of two ways. First, if you'd like to ask a question live to Jake, just press 1 on your telephone keypad and you'll be entered into the queue. Alternatively, you can feel free to email your question to us at info@businessfwd.org, and then I'll read that question aloud for you. When we call on you to ask your question live, please introduce yourself with your business and where you're calling from. And if you email us a question, please include that same information in your email. Again, to ask a question, once Jake gets through his remarks, you can press 1 on your telephone keypad and I'll just call on you, or you can email us your question to info@businessfwd.org and we'll just add that into the queue. So with that, I'd like to hand it over to Jake Sullivan. Jake, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thanks to everybody on the phone for taking the time out of what I'm sure are very busy afternoons to participate in this conversation. I thought I would just take a few minutes at the top before we get to the questions to give you a little bit of background on this new organization, National Security Action, and then to talk at sort of 30,000 feet about the current direction of U.S. foreign policy under the Trump administration, some of the concerns I see. And use that as a predicate then, or a launching pad for some back and forth in the Q&A period. So just starting with this organization, National Security Action, which I serve as a co-chair of, we've stood this up just in the past few months as a new advocacy group that is specifically focused on holding President Trump and his team accountable for what we see as their reckless and erratic foreign policy, and to advance a strong and principled alternative vision of what American leadership can and should look like at this time. We're not a think tank or policy shop. What we are is an organization that's dedicated to shaping the public debate on foreign policy and national security, and frankly, to moving the political needle on these issues. We see our comparative advantage as serving as the connective tissue between and among national security experts, existing advocacy groups, Congress and the political world. Fundamentally, we're a service organization, for members of Congress, for candidates, for progressive organizations. So our brand is not really what's important. What's important is that we be able to provide to anyone interested in foreign policy and national security the tools and resources and arguments that they need to be able to make the case for why a lot of what we are seeing is wrong and what the right approach would be on everything from North Korea to trade to some of the other issues that we'll talk about today. And I guess the last thing that I would say about National Security Action is that we're not seeking to establish a permanent structure. This is a group whose purpose is the purpose is limited to seeing our way through this time of alarm, this emergency moment. And our goal is basically to put ourselves out of business in 2020. But in the meantime, there's much work to do, and we look forward to working with many of you on the call. Just to go all the way back out and take a broad perspective on where I think we are right now, one of the most corrosive things that's happening with the succession of decisions and actions that President Trump has taken over the past 18 months is that he is step by step surrendering America's hard-won global leadership. And he's doing that by isolating us from our allies, creating new opportunities and spaces for many of our competitors, and weakening the image and the actual power of the United States as a global leader. And one great example of this are all of the recent opinion surveys that have come out reflecting plummeting support and respect for the United States. One study in the last few months has shown that for the first time ever, more people now respect China's leadership than ours. That's people around the world. And to take an example from across the Atlantic, in Germany, a recent survey showed that only 13% of people now trust the United States, while 36% of Germans trust Russia. Perhaps the way that this has been summed up by some of our allies and partners was in a tweet by the president of the European Commission a few days ago when he said, "With friends like these, who needs enemies?" And that was speaking of us, of the United States of America. Now, why does this matter? I mean, as many of you on the call know, over time, this is going to have real costs. It's going to make it harder for us to be in the driver's seat in terms of setting the economic rules of the road and in the face of a rising China and in the face of the types of new challenges to free and open competition, from state-owned enterprises to currency manipulation to those ever-shifting barriers behind borders that are hard to get a handle on. We're just going to have a harder time setting the agenda. It will make it harder for us to mobilize cooperation on major challenges like pandemics and climate and terrorism. And frankly, it will mean that others will start getting together to call the shots at our expense. But there's also very direct, tangible impacts right here at home to the policies that we're seeing this president pursue. The face that Donald Trump is showing to the world, the way in which he's sort of saying to others, you know, essentially a version of screw you, combined with his anti-immigration rhetoric and policies, have contributed to what tourism experts refer to as the, quote, Trump slump, that millions of people have decided, you know what, we're not going to visit the U.S. this year. And that has cost the U.S. economy billions of dollars and tens of thousands of jobs, if not hundreds of thousands of jobs already. And, you know, a nearly 7% expected drop of travelers is expected to be sustained or grow over time, which will continue to hit retailers and small businesses and people who count on tourism, which, by the way, is one of America's great exports. So in these very direct ways, as well as in these systemic ways, the Trump policies are already coming home and forcing the United States to pay a price. Now, part of what is motivating or driving the sense that America's not quite as open for people to come and feel comfortable visiting or even coming here to study or coming here to start a new business is the Muslim ban. The president announced the first version of it shortly after taking office. He's moved on to his second version and now finally on to the third version that's currently before the Supreme Court. Now, the fact is that this ban would affect less than 0.1% of all visitors, but the rhetoric around it and the message that it sends more broadly to the world about who we are and what we stand for has damaged the U.S. brand as a destination, according to tourism experts. And according to academic experts, it has driven a notable decline in international enrollment in our universities. So the best and the brightest from the rest of the world who used to come here and then create the new industries and new innovations are choosing to go elsewhere. And the fact is that there is no national security argument for this ban. No American has been killed in a terrorist attack in the United States by a national of one of the countries who is listed in the ban. The administration has provided no evidence or specific information that nationals of the banned countries are a threat to the safety of Americans if they're allowed to enter the United States. Look, we have the capacity to protect this country through an individualized determination, through any one person coming and having to demonstrate that they will travel here in a way that is safe and that they mean no harm to anyone in the United States. We can make that work, we can tighten that up, but to have this blanket ban that is fundamentally cloaking, attempting to cloak, but not very effectively, a certain form of bigotry, not only does it make national security sense, it's inconsistent with who we are as a people. And at the same time that we're driving this very consistent, very negative message about America's doors being open to strivers and seekers from around the world, we're also sending a message that America's not exactly entirely open for business when it comes to trade and commerce. You know, we've all been watching the to-ing and fro-ing around the potential for a trade war with China. And I was particularly struck a few days ago when the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, sort of offhandedly said in an interview, the trade war is on hold. It's a remarkably casual way to treat an issue that has the capacity to deeply harm the American economy and the global economy. The trade war is on hold, it's off hold, it's back on hold, etc. And now, most recently, the Trump administration has said that they intend to move forward with tariffs on a significant amount of Chinese products, right at a moment when they're also trying to work out with the Chinese solutions to some of the challenges that have been put on the table. Look, the fact is that all of us can agree that there are problems with the approach that China takes on certain of its business and trade practices, including on intellectual property, and that we need solutions to these problems. But the solution is not an erratic will he or won't he game that Trump seems to be playing in a bilateral way with the Chinese. The solution is to work together with all of our friends in like-minded countries, countries whose collective GDP creates enormous leverage, to shape the rules that then put pressure on the Chinese to have to come into compliance with them. But instead of doing that, instead of going down that road, what are we doing? We're picking fights with our friends in Europe, picking fights with our friends in Japan and other places, and sort of saying to them, you know what, we'd rather go at you on some other issue than work with you on the issue of our time, which is how do we make sure that China becomes a more constructive economic actor. And at the same time that Trump is engaged in this zigging and zagging around the China issue, real Americans are getting hurt. That's already been the case with the slowdown that we've seen in agricultural exports. It threatens to be the case when it comes to the possibility that China will turn around and slap tariffs on other U.S. products. And it's no surprise that back in March, a collection of retailers from Walmart to Abercrombie and Fitch and others wrote to Trump to protest tariffs, saying basically these hit the middle class. American families are ultimately going to be the people who bear the brunt of these tariffs, and alongside them will be the small business owners and the merchants and others who just get caught in the crossfire in a strategy whose objective of improving China's trade policy is sound, but the actual means by which they're going about doing it is deeply harmful and thus far has not borne any fruit. And the last thing that I will just say on the trade war piece that I think is important to underscore is it is very hard to separate the economic decision making of this administration, who they choose to go after when, and when they choose to lay off and why, from Donald Trump and his family's own business interests. Nowhere is this more true than in this recent debacle involving the Chinese telecommunications firm ZTE. So a longstanding effort by the Commerce Department and the national security community of the United States found that ZTE had been flagrantly in breach of U.S. sanctions on Iran and North Korea. The Trump administration putatively cares a lot about those Iran sanctions since they ripped up the JCPOA, something we can talk about in the back and forth. And yet, shortly after the Chinese invested hundreds of millions of dollars in a Trump property in Indonesia, Trump turned around and expressed public support for lifting the sanctions on ZTE and saving, in his words, Chinese jobs along the way. That is a very strange set of priorities where we are watching Donald Trump not put America first, but putting his interests and those of his families first instead. The last topic I just want to briefly touch on, because it's so much in the news these days, is North Korea. I am very pleased that today we are talking more about diplomacy with North Korea than war with North Korea, which was the order of the day a few months ago, because as Winston Churchill famously said, jaw-jaw is better than war-war. However, the means by which Donald Trump is going about this diplomacy suggests that he's really in it, not for the reality of the threat of North Korea's nuclear and missile programs, but the reality show of Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, right down to the commemorative coin that has been minted for purposes of the summit. And there's a new episode every day. You know, one day it's the whole thing's off. The next day it's, you know, Kim and I are great friends. The next day it's on to some other new development, all designed essentially to create maximum drama and not to create maximum progress on America's core national security objectives. What I anticipate will happen here is that there will be a summit in the very near future. Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump will sit down. They will agree to a loose framework that involves promises for promises. North Korea will take some largely cosmetic steps as an initial kind of good faith matter beyond what they've already done in terms of blowing up their nuclear test site. And Trump will come out and say, I've done it. I've solved it. I've solved the North Korea issue in a way that none of the losers and haters who came before me could, and it's mission accomplished. Now, on the one hand, I don't think it is catastrophic if there is an ongoing diplomatic process and Trump is running around, you know, essentially engaged in some loose form of trash talk. On the other hand, there are very real risks and dangers to prematurely declaring mission accomplished on the North Korea file, because over time, the North Koreans will be driving a wedge between us and South Korea. China and North Korea will be looking to take advantage of the United States, essentially saying, we're done, we finished, it's all over. And North Korea all along will maintain the very capacity, the nuclear and missile capacity that brought us into the situation in the first place. So from my perspective, through all the Sturm und Drang and all the drama, we level-headed people need to just be asking a very basic question, which is, it's great that you've got a piece of paper, it's great that you're giving a hug to Kim Jong-un, but have you actually gotten the nukes and the missiles out of North Korea? And if you haven't, then you can't say you've solved the problem. And until then, you have to keep working at it. And really, you've gotten no further at the end of the day than any previous American president. So let's all encourage progress. I don't think we should attack the process other than to call out this kind of unnecessary drama. But let's not let Donald Trump prematurely declare mission accomplished because of all of the risks that that brings along with it. So let me close there and just say, you know, for those of you on the call, you've all seen, read, heard, and lived to a certain extent the implications of some of Trump's reckless and dangerous policies. We know there can be a long tail on economic policy and that some of the repercussions won't be evident for some time. But all of us have a voice. And as with that open letter from the retailers and business leaders I talked about, you know, all of our the leaders in our business community have to continue to speak out publicly against the policies that concern you, but also contribute to a confident, optimistic, alternative vision that is strong and principled and says, you know what, there's a better way for America to go about this. And that is a project that I would love to work with all of you on as we go forward. So we're pleased to be a resource in this fight. We're pleased to be able to partner with many of you and with Business Forward on issues that are of common interest to us. And we look forward to staying in touch in the days ahead. And with that, I will open it up for questions. Thank you.
Great. Jake, Thank you for that comprehensive overview of kind of what's going on out there. As a reminder to everybody on the phone, if you'd like to ask a question, you can press 1 on your telephone keypad, and I'll just call on you to ask that question, or you can email us your question. We've already gotten a couple emailed questions, which we will start with as folks get into the queue here. First, Jake, when you were at the State Department, you worked extensively on this idea of a pivot to Asia, and you just talked a lot about China and the United States trade policy and how that's gone back and forth a lot. Could you really explicitly maybe explain what that pivot to Asia focus was for many years and what has switched, and maybe discuss a little bit what that means for America's leadership and China's power? You also touched on that in the beginning a little bit when you talked about the fact that more people trust China than the U.S.
Sure. The concept of the pivot to Asia was first captured actually in an article that Hillary Clinton wrote in Foreign Policy magazine in 2011, which was titled America's Pacific Century. And the basic thrust of the argument and the basic thrust of the policy in the Obama administration was that the Asia Pacific is going to be the place where much of the history of the 21st century is written. This is an area of enormous economic, strategic, political importance to the United States and to the world, whether you're talking about the world's largest economies or you're talking about the world's biggest climate carbon emitters, or you're talking about the possibility of geopolitical conflict, not just among the established power and the rising power of the United States and China, but also tensions between China and Japan and other challenges throughout the region and the South China Sea and elsewhere. So this is a region of just absolutely vital importance. And when the Obama administration came in, we recognized that we were very heavily weighted in the Middle East and not nearly weighted heavily enough in the Asia Pacific, given the central importance of it to the years and decades ahead. Any good strategy towards Asia, let me put that a different way. Any good strategy towards China, any attempt to deal maturely, effectively, strategically with China's rise has to involve a good policy towards Asia writ large. The United States just thinking about the China relationship in a strictly bilateral way that Trump does, let's just go sit down with them and try and work everything out, will in the end not work to the United States' advantage, because we have allies in Asia and we have like-minded partners, including emerging partnerships with countries like Singapore and Vietnam and India. And so what we were trying to do was to put together an integrated strategy that involved a military dimension by increasing our presence in the region to show that the United States wasn't going anywhere, that involved a diplomatic dimension by joining the East Asia Summit, which is the major security and political organization in the Asia Pacific that the United States didn't even have a seat at the table at, and that had an economic dimension through the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which encompassed 40% of the world's GDP and was trying to set new rules on issues from digital data flows to intellectual property to state-owned enterprises. What Trump has done, And you know, the results were mixed, and I concede that we came with a lot of momentum out of the gate, made quite a bit of progress, but in the end did not deliver on all that we hoped to, including, of course, TPP ending up going by the boards. But, you know, along comes Donald Trump, and what Trump basically says is, I don't think in terms of multilateralism. I don't think in terms of a region of the world. I think about individual countries and my individual problems with them, and I'm going to deal with them one by one. So he rips up TPP and says, I only care about bilateral trade deals, which takes the U.S. out of the rule setting business in the most important place where the rules need to be set. He, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, he abandons any kind of multilateral approach to China on common concerns that many like-minded countries have with China. He picks fights with both Japan and Korea when it comes to trade. He picks fights with Australia when it comes to issues related to immigration. And the net result of all of it is that Trump basically looks out at Asia and he sees, in my view, two things. He sees a China trade war that he wants to manage through, and he sees a North Korea nuclear issue that he wants to get a Nobel Prize for solving. And otherwise, he's not thinking about situating the United States as a resident power in Asia that's playing a central role in maintaining peace and stability and in elevating the economic rules of the road for that region. And I think this is one of those areas where you're not going to feel it on any given day, but over time, it will become increasingly apparent that the rest of the region is adjusting to a more diminished role for the United States, and that will come at a cost to us. And it will accrue to the benefit of China, who right now is taking maximum advantage of the vacuum that President Trump has left on a wide variety of issues across the region. So that is my concern. The answer is not, you know, just to say, oh, everything Trump is doing is wrong. The answer is also to say, okay, let's get ready for the world after Trump. And what are we going to do to make sure that we not only reclaim the priority that the Asia Pacific should play in American foreign policy, but also be prepared to execute against that in ways that materially advance U.S. interests.
Great, thank you. We're going to move to some live questions now. When I call on you, that means your line will be open and live. So please introduce yourself with your business and where you're calling from, and then go ahead and ask your question or share your advice with us. The first question is from Dr. Toby Malachi. Dr. Malachi, your line should be open. Go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you. Thank you, Elizabeth, and good to hear your voice again and everyone on. Jake, what an honor to have you on. I'm Dr. Toby Malachi, founder and chief executive officer and global business diplomat here of Malachi Group Worldwide, based in Indianapolis, Indiana. I'm also, Jake, the vice chairman of the U.S. Foreign Commercial Service, U.S. Department of Commerce, Indiana District Export Council. My question is, and thank you so much for your time, is in terms of free trade. Jake, was recently published by The Hill on April 27th, 2018 on what I called international trade is big business for Indiana small businesses, the home of my friend Mike Pence. And the articles received a great bit of attention, not just here, but around the country and around the world. My concern and my question is that I predicted also a year and a half ago, some called me crazy, that we will be back in TPP. I've had the honor to advocate and be a part of almost 80% of our free trade agreements in America, representing our small, medium-sized enterprises. The question is here, House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Kevin Brady said, trade is our last economic freedom. I agree wholeheartedly with this, and of course, I'm very disappointed that we're not in TPP, but we'll go back to TPP. You said something of great note, and that is, we have lost a great deal of standing in the world. It's very difficult now that I think with these responses coming out of the current administration on bilateral approaches to multilateral solutions for free trade agreement, I think it's going to kill the free enterprise system in terms of SMEs exporting abroad and run up against the attitude that's currently changed against us. As becoming a second class trade country as opposed to the world's most powerful. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that and help we SMEs, as you see it through your new organization, National Security Actions, on how we might be a part of that and help move the needle from the attitude of bilateral approaches to multilateral solutions for free trade agreements?
Thank you very much, first of all, for all the work you've done over the years and for the advocacy you're doing publicly and for the question. You know, it's interesting. This for the president himself, this aversion to anything multilateral runs really deep and has been, for a guy who's not particularly consistent on policy issues over the years, this is something that has been a theme that's run through the last 30 years of Donald Trump's public pronouncements. He fundamentally believes, and frankly, Wilbur Ross, the Secretary of Commerce, also believes this, that as soon as the United States is involved in a multilateral trade negotiation, it is necessarily giving up some of its leverage, that it can exercise better by just sitting across the table bilaterally from another country and squeezing them, because we're the bigger dog, and in a dog-eat-dog world, the bigger dog wins. What this misunderstands, what this misses, is that trade deals have evolved from being kind of basic questions around how high or low is your tariff, you know, or do you have a tariff at all? It's no longer just about the question of reducing barriers. If you look at TPP, it's about a host of other issues where we want to get the entire world set up on a set of rules that create a playing field that's level, that the United States can compete and win on, that our small and medium-sized enterprises can take advantage of. So in the technology space, you know, when you're talking about digital data flows, when you're talking about a whole host of barriers to American exports that aren't covered at all by the WTO, how do we get rules in place that every country has to abide by that allows for the United States' small businesses to be able to compete against everyone else, as I said, on a level playing field? That I don't hold out a lot of hope we're going to convince Trump of that. But I actually believe that if we build a bipartisan constituency in the Congress for this view, and if we begin to do a better job of educating the public about what the nature of modern trade agreements are, and in some ways they just go beyond trade agreements, they're about so much more than that, that we will be in a better position to bring pressure from below up on the administration, and also to set the groundwork for a more positive conversation about trade heading into the future. I would also say that it is very important that the 2020 conversation on the issue of trade and international investment and the like not end up going down the same kind of rabbit holes that oftentimes happens in political campaigns. So I think we all also have work to do to try to shape that conversation in a way where people correctly talk about the need for the United States to do a better job on the enforcement side. And frankly, in the terms that we put into our multilateral trade agreements, that we think harder about how we make sure it's delivering jobs and rising wages for working people, but fundamentally that we embrace what you said, which is that the United States has to be able to trade with the rest of the world. 95% of the world's consumers do not live in the United States, and being able to access those markets is going to become increasingly important over time. So I think we have work to do, both in terms of how we work with the Hill and how we work with candidates thinking about running in 2020, and how we continue to try to bring pressure to bear on the administration itself.
Thank you. We're going to move to another live question. Our next question is from Chadwick Fernandez. Mr. Fernandez, your line should be open. Please introduce yourself with your business and where you're calling from.
All right. Thank you. Good afternoon. Chad Fernandez with Nerva Corporation, and I'm calling out of Tampa. And I just wanted to, you kind of touched on this a minute ago in your last answer, but I was hoping maybe you could elaborate a little more. I wanted to get your thoughts or advice on how Democrats in general can keep the national security conversation front and center with the American people at a time when really any question we raise about any of the decisions that the president is making and what some of us see as long-term damage being caused ends up getting, I guess, consumed by either deflection or some other conspiracy. It's basically anytime we raise a question, it gets dismissed. What are the things you would advise us to kind of focus on to keep the American people engaged?
Right. So it's a great question, and we're still working through how best to address this. We're doing our own sort of survey research to get a better sense of American attitudes on these issues, to make sure that we're refining the advice that we're giving to members, to business leaders, et cetera. But I guess I would say this. One, as you note, if you just kind of fire every bullet in the gun in every direction, for everything that Donald Trump has said or done in the last 18 months that is problematic or wrong or immoral or sets back the cause of American interests, you'll be just kind of spraying buckshot everywhere, but you're not necessarily going to hit your target. So you've got to pick your spots, and you've got to narrow the list of critiques to a consistent drumbeat on a few salient things. And that leads to, naturally, the question, well, what then? And I would argue that there are at least two important critiques that we should be consistently making when it comes to U.S. foreign policy. The first has to do with respect, and goes back to the beginning of my remarks, that the United States has lost dramatically in terms of its standing in the world, the respect other countries have for us, the degree to which the American people, you know, are being embarrassed by their president overseas and how he treats others. This is something that over time has proven to be, even for people who don't care that much about foreign policy on any given day, they do care that the United States is seen as a respected, upstanding member of the international community, is a leader in the international community. And I think we have to drive the message that Donald Trump has eroded all of that in really dramatic and decisive ways. And then the second is another thing that I talked a little bit about in my opening, which is to consistently push the theme that many of Donald Trump's decisions about how he deals with the Saudis or the Filipinos or the Turks or the Chinese turn on whether he has hotel interests in those countries or hotel interests that those countries can help him with. And the same thing goes for Ivanka Trump's brands, which we've now learned about over the last 48 hours, that there is a corrupt element to this that we have to hammer and tie back a whole series of decisions over the course of months and years to the basic proposition that he's putting business interests ahead of the American interest. And I think that is another core theme that we need to drive. Now, Trump's main argument in response is going to be, well, look, I've solved North Korea, and so I should get the Nobel Prize and I'm a success in foreign policy. And I think what we need to do on the North Korea thing, as I mentioned up front, is not take the bait of just attacking everything he does willy-nilly, say, oh, it's terrible, today is terrible, tomorrow is terrible, the next day is terrible. I think we have to be more level-headed and calm in our approach to this and consistent in a way that I think will ultimately break through to people. So he has a summit, he has an ongoing diplomatic process. That's all to the good. We want diplomacy and not war. And frankly, Trump could get us off into a war any given day, which is another concern we should have about him. But we should have a line that basically says, don't let this guy declare success until he's actually succeeded. And success means that North Korea actually gives up its nuclear weapons and missiles. And by the way, the odds of them doing so, I believe, are vanishingly small. So I think if we just hold to that line, we will ultimately be vindicated. So it's having a cool, clear-eyed view on North Korea combined with driving affirmative lines of critique on these other two themes that I've just described that I think will put us in the best position to be able to make the case that there is a better way to go about these things. Last two things I will say on this issue. It used to be almost boring or banal to say, we believe the United States should have strong allies and good friends in the world, and we believe the United States should stand for certain values. Like, that was about as generic as you could get. But it turns out that Donald Trump has put both of those propositions in serious contest. So I think we should also be prepared to stand up for those things and to assert them at every turn and to say, if you believe in these things, then you should support an alternative to what we currently have in the White House. Those are some initial thoughts, but I think your question is fantastic because it's a puzzle that is not just relevant to national security. It's relevant across the board, and we all have our work cut out for us in trying to make sure we can hold this guy accountable and not just, you know, fire our buckshot in every direction.
Great, thanks. We've just got time for a couple more questions here. We have one more live question that we're going to go to, and that's from Dana Marshall. Dana, your live is open. Go ahead. Your line is open. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thanks very much. It's Dana Marshall, Transnational Strategy Group. And Jake, it's always a pleasure to hear you, and thank you for that very comprehensive readout. My focus on the question and comment is more on the international economic side. You gave a pretty good presentation of the problems that the Trump sort of quote-unquote strategy is causing. But I would argue that there's even something worse going on, that not only is there is the sort of the strategy wrong, but he's never enunciated very clearly what are the goals of the strategy. And the goals that he has enunciated, and the preeminent one, of course, is the reduction of the trade deficit, is, I think, has been widely acknowledged, perhaps one of many, many areas that need to be looked at. So the point that I would say, or sort of the comment and maybe a question for you, is that I think it's really important in any endeavor to identify very clearly what are the goals of our international economic policy. And also very much to focus not only on the policy side and the impact on foreign policy, but the impact on voters who, many of whom were swayed, arguably, by what Trump was saying, though he didn't define many of these things back in the last election. So I would say that perhaps National Security Action or some group could devote some useful time to defining more clearly what are the important policy, economic, and domestic political goals of our international economic policy, whether it's the trade agreements, bilateral investment treaties, pushing back on the China Belt Road Initiative, you name it, so that we can be, so that when the time comes to be able to put these in more of a political context, that we'll be able to do that, I think, more naturally. Just want to get any thoughts on that.
Yeah, so first of all, I do agree that Donald Trump himself doesn't really think in terms of objectives beyond the narrow question of things like easy metrics like the trade deficit and so forth. But I think your question is really important because, frankly, I don't believe the Democratic Party has been particularly clear about what exactly the economic objectives of our foreign economic policy are either on the campaign trail or in governing. You know, we talk about one of the core sort of national security interests of the United States to be advancing prosperity and advancing America's economic interests around the world. But what are those interests exactly? And whose interests are they? And how do we make sure that at the end of the day, everything we're doing in our foreign economic policy comes back to the core issue of making sure that we're securing and sustaining a vibrant middle class in this country that provides the consumer base and the knowledge base that drives and powers our businesses and our economy. For me, that becomes the core question. And I think we have to look in the mirror and say we can do a better job of that going forward. What would a foreign economic policy with that as the North Star look like in terms of some adjustments from what we've done in the past while holding on to the notion that the only way to succeed, we know, is by engaging with the rest of the world, being forward-leaning and setting the terms and rules of trade and investment in the world. But, you know, as we think about the content, how do we connect it back to that basic core objective? I think that's important. On the issue of, you know, we've tried a lot of these arguments. They didn't work against Trump in 2016. I would say a couple things. First, you're right. We have to constantly be looking for new ways of trying to reach people who we have not been able to reach thus far. And I will be the first to acknowledge that. But the second thing I would say is we should not overlearn the lessons of 2016. Many people went into the voting booth and cast votes for Donald Trump despite their misgivings about him as commander-in-chief and his approach on foreign policy and national security. And these arguments did have purchase with those voters. They didn't override other things for unique reasons in the 2016 election. But I don't think we should throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think continuing to drive issues around respect and recklessness and corruption, you know, consistently, they show not only that they lift energy among certain portions of the public, but they do give pause, maybe not to the hardest of hardcore, but to many people who would like to see a more stable, more mature, more public-oriented commander-in-chief. And so I think we need to balance making sure that we're not just trying the same thing over and over again that's not working with recognizing, you know, what didn't work and what did work. It's not clear that every argument that we made was of no use at all in a very complicated contingent election in 2016. So those are just some thoughts to what I thought was a very good intervention. Thank you.